at Origin, the National Centre of Excellence in Youth Mental Health, and a professorial fellow at the Centre for Youth Mental Health at the University of Melbourne. He is also Director of Clinical Services at Origin Youth in Melbourne, Australia. Andrew's clinical research and knowledge translation interests lie in prevention and early intervention for severe mental disorders, principally personality disorder, along with mood and psychotic disorders. He established and directs the Helping Young People Early, HYPE, program, which has been recognized with several awards for advancing healthcare. Andrew has over 120 scientific publications and a forthcoming book, Early Intervention for Borderline Personality Disorder, to be published by Cambridge University Press. He is the past president of the International Society for the Study of Personality Disorders and the recipient of the 2017 Award for Distinguished Achievement in the Field of Severe Personality Disorders from the Borderline Personality Disorder Research Center and Personality Disorder Institute in New York. Andrew, it's wonderful to have you here, and thanks so much for phoning in on what I believe will be a sunny day in Melbourne. And am I right that it's about 12 p.m. there?
It is. It's midday, and thank you, Emily. It's a beautiful day, beautiful and sunny, so I'm sorry to make all you North Americans very jealous. It's a real pleasure to be able to speak with you. I'm more than happy to be interrupted along the way with questions, and Emily, I'll leave that to your discretion. But I do have a number of slides to present to you, and also available on the NEA-BPD website is a paper that that I wrote along with Carla Sharp and Perry Hoffman, which you can download, which is really the kind of position statement about why we should be doing prevention and early intervention for borderline personality disorder. It's more of a technical paper, but I hope that this might simplify and present things in a more user-friendly kind of format. So just to let you know that I have no conflict of interest to declare, and if you have a look at the slide set while I'm talking, I'll talk through this, and perhaps not to interrupt the flow, I'll just keep proceeding, and the slides will progress reasonably quickly. So the first point I wanted to make is that personality disorder begins in childhood and adolescence, but if you read the DSM-5 or the ICD-10, which is the International Classification of Diseases, and you look at the sections on disorders of childhood and adolescence, there is no mention of personality disorder in these manuals. And yet there is strong scientific evidence to suggest that these disorders do begin in childhood and adolescence. And you can see in the next slide the age of onset for borderline personality disorder. These are data that, in fact, Perry Hoffman has kindly given to me to use. And they were taken from a survey conducted on your own website, asking families to rate when they thought the signs of the disorder were first evident. And you can see that there's a huge peak around puberty and early adolescence when people first notice the signs of borderline personality disorder. But also what is noteworthy is some people's problems were even noticeable earlier than that. When you use the traditional diagnostic criteria, in fact, borderline personality disorder is among the most common problems that are seen in psychiatric practice. About one in five psychiatric outpatients, whether they be young people or adults, are people with borderline personality disorder. And the reason that we choose borderline personality disorder for early intervention, or we focus on it, is because borderline is really another term for severe personality disorder, and work from Carla Sharp, my colleague in Houston, has shown very nicely that BPD, the criteria for BPD, are really a marker of severity for personality disorder. And what they do is they demarcate a group of individuals who are at high risk of both poor health outcomes and also, sadly, death as a result of having the disorder. And so we're not really interested in just the narrow diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. Our focus is on BPD because this is a group of individuals who, if they've ever had any of the features of the disorder, are at risk of markedly poor outcomes compared with their peers who've never had any of the features of borderline personality disorder. And what I'll show you is that actually the seeds of harm from borderline personality disorder are sown very early in the course of the disorder, and they're very broad. They're not just around self-harm and suicide. They're around a whole range of poor outcomes. And in fact, severe and persistent functional disability is probably the most under-recognized and most devastating hallmark of borderline personality disorder. Among 15 to 34-year-olds, borderline personality disorder is the fourth leading cause of disability in females and the sixth in males. And Australian data, and we have about a 12th or a 13th of the US population, shows that the annual cost of reduced employment participation among young people with borderline personality disorder is $500 million. So this is a very expensive disorder from both a personal and a social and an economic point of view. Having any borderline features at age 14 predicts poor academic and occupational attainment and more reliance on welfare payments. In our own work, 57% of the young people who come to our program with BPD are not in education, employment or training. That is, have no meaningful engagement in education or employment. And that is statistically not significantly different from those presenting with their first episode of psychosis. And in fact, again, local data from Australia show that only 40% of people who have had the opportunity to complete high school or equivalent actually do if they have BPD, compared with 87% of their healthy peers in the community. So you can see that borderline personality disorder has wide-ranging social and educational and vocational ramifications. Personality disorder is also more strongly associated with receiving disability benefits than either anxiety or depression, and among the personality disorders, borderline features have the strongest positive association with receiving disability benefits, and people with borderline personality disorder are 8 times more likely to be receiving disability benefits than those with no personality disorder. And at some stage over a 10-year period, around about half of people with BPD will be in receipt of disability benefits. Unemployment is high, about 45% long-term unemployment. As I said, many people on disability benefits. And we think of borderline personality disorder as being a costly disorder because we think about emergency department attendances and we think about admissions to psychiatric hospitals or intensive care units following overdoses, but actually the majority of the costs associated with borderline personality disorder are due to work-related disability. This is a disorder that comes on early, steers people off a healthy developmental trajectory into adulthood, and then of course people live many decades with disability, not engaged in education, employment or training. So it stands to reason that this is going to be a very costly disorder that strikes people down at the very time where they should be making the transition into adult roles in the workforce and in the community. One of the other untold consequences of borderline personality disorder is the poor physical, sexual and reproductive health of those who have the disorder. There's an association with cardiovascular disease, arthritis, gastrointestinal conditions, and those young people with borderline personality disorder have significantly greater substance use than their healthy peers, and in fact this substance use is a predictor of their later mortality. We've also found that people with BPD enter sexual relationships at a younger age, have more unsafe sex, and experience more sexual violence. And sadly, about 8% of people with borderline personality disorder will die by suicide, usually early in the course of the disorder, within the first 5 years of diagnosis. But I think the most sobering and striking statistic about borderline and severe personality disorder more generally is that patients with severe personality disorder have a two-decade reduction in life expectancy compared with their peers in the community. And this is a national and an international tragedy. If it were affecting any other patient group or any other group in the community, then people would be crying out loud that this is a national tragedy. But we don't hear about the reduction in life expectancy for people with borderline personality disorder. So I hope that gives you an indication of the personal and the social and the economic costs of borderline personality disorder. And given all of that, how do we approach this problem? Well, this is the way I describe it. We try to unscramble the eggs. We wait until the eggs are truly scrambled, and then we think, well, we probably need to try and rescue some of this. And the whole mental health system internationally is geared toward late intervention. It's the norm. We delay diagnosis. We're very shy about making the diagnosis in young people. And typically, people only receive treatment, if they receive it at all, very late in the course of the disorder, when these functional impairments are already well entrenched and when the harms that can be perpetrated by the health system have already done their damage. And then, of course, we have only modestly effective treatments, and these treatments have very little effect on functional recovery. So people might stop harming themselves or be a little less impulsive, but actually they're usually living quiet lives of desperation with not much in the way of social relationships and very poor functioning. This is a recent review in a very important psychiatric journal that shows that psychotherapies for borderline personality disorder are only modestly effective. Now, on the one hand, that's a really good news story, that we have now robust evidence that psychotherapies are effective, but we also have the evidence showing that we need to be able to do a much better job. And I think part of the reason that these therapies are only modestly effective is because we approach the problems way down the course of the disorder. We approach it too late. This is really the evidence for late intervention. And the good news is late intervention can achieve meaningful outcomes. The bad news is that these outcomes are far from optimal.
Andrew,
and essentially,
can you speak to this a little bit more? Because I'm just thinking for many of our viewers, you know, who are less scientifically sophisticated as you, this is just going to look like a bunch of numbers. So I wonder if you can, I think it's an incredibly important table, and I wonder if you can sort of just describe in a little more detail for those of us who are less au fait with this material, exactly what this signifies.
Sure. The table that Emily's referring to is the slide that's headed Psychotherapies Are Only Modestly Effective. And essentially what this is it pulls all the data together from all of the published trials in adults and can compare whether the treatment is favoured or whether the control treatment is favoured. The gold standard for comparing one treatment with another is to do what's called a randomised controlled trial, where people are allocated at the toss of a coin to either the intervention that you're interested in or the comparison intervention. The line down the middle, you can see on one side says favours psychotherapy and the other says favours control. And if the square dot and the line that is either side of that dot to the right-hand side and don't touch the vertical dotted line, it means that the psychotherapy intervention is favoured. If it's on the other side of the line, then it means the control intervention is favoured over the psychotherapy intervention. And what you can see there is some of the studies show very effective treatments, and some of them, because the horizontal line touches that vertical dotted line, indicate that probably they're no different to the control treatment. And down the bottom there, you can see the diamond, which pulls together all the data from all these trials. And this is really the highest level of evidence. And what it says that overall, if you take all the noise in these studies into account, that actually there is evidence with from all these studies that the individual psychotherapies that have been tested in these studies are more effective than the control treatments, which are generally either treatment as usual or sometimes they're actually a structured treatment for borderline personality disorder. So it's a good news story. It says treatments are effective. And just to put it in context, if you do the same thing looking at antidepressant trials for depression, you wind up with an almost identical finding that antidepressants are modestly effective for depression. And no one's saying let's throw out antidepressant treatment and not pursue antidepressants for treatment of depression. I think really what it does is just help us get an idea about the size of the effect, that it's a modest effect and that it means we can't rest on our laurels and we need to try much harder to improve the treatments that we have or to approach treatment in a different way so that we can be more effective in our intervention. Does that make sense?
It does to me.
Okay. And, if there are questions, like I'm happy to have it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Shall I go on and
yeah,
continue?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So, look, you can see there a picture of lots of different laundry detergents. And the reason for that is that essentially what I'm saying is that all of these treatments are like laundry detergents. They all get your clothes clean. However, they make claims for different kinds of effectiveness, or they make certain claims for each of the types of psychotherapy. What the evidence tells us is that no one treatment is superior to another. There's much better evidence for certain treatments, but no one treatment is superior to another, despite what they say on the pack. However, they are all effective, and I think that's important to remember, that structured treatments for borderline personality disorder are effective. And importantly, another good news story is that that means there's a choice about treatments that are available, because not every treatment suits every individual or every clinician for that matter. And so there are a variety of treatments that are available. They will all do the job, and they will do it to modest effect. But the problem with late intervention and the way we approach treatment at the moment is that the delay in diagnosis and treatment is potentially harmful, because we decrease the likelihood of appropriate intervention, we increase the likelihood of inappropriate or harmful intervention, especially inappropriate prescribing if people are sent down the wrong pathway, or possibly worse, what's called polypharmacy, this problem that people with borderline personality disorder have, where they end up on numerous medications, many of, if not most of which, are ineffective, and that instead of stopping medications, people just keep adding them. And the medications themselves can very often lead to their own harms that make the situation worse, not better. So really what I'm leading up to here is that early diagnosis and treatment leads to clinically meaningful improvements. And we know from the evidence base in the treatment of young people, not the data I just showed you, but the smaller evidence base for young people, that these evidence-based treatments are more effective than treatment as usual. And so what we need in order to improve care is a health system response to borderline personality disorder, not just an individual psychotherapy response or a case-by-case response. The problems we have in most countries are that the health service systems that we have are not fit for purpose for borderline personality disorder. There's no coordination, there's an excessive focus on self-harm and hospitalisation, an excessive focus on individual psychotherapy over and above the broader needs of people with BPD. Families are marginalised, And a fee-for-service environment is often unsuited to many, if not most people, particularly people with severe borderline personality disorder. They're often too disorganized or too financially disadvantaged to be able to access fee-for-service care. And so this kind of environment really counts against them ever getting effective care. And we know that although there are these terrific individual treatments that we have that you saw summarized in that slide, access to these treatments is extremely poor. And even when people get into these treatments, dropout from these treatments is unacceptably high. So if most of the harms associated with personality disorder emerge early, then we really need to intervene early. We need to try and stop that egg from breaking or scrambling before it even has cracks in it. We need to try and preserve the egg as whole as we can. And there's often a misconception about early intervention. Not all treatment that occurs among young people is actually early intervention. There are many young people who present for treatment with severe personality disorder who already have enduring problems. Those people who are often in custodial settings, out-of-home care settings, people presenting with a range of difficulties that can often be well entrenched well before the age of 18. And there's nothing magical about the treatment of this group of patients. This should be a stock standard intervention for borderline personality disorder. They just happen to be under the age of 18. So that's not what I mean by when I talk about early intervention. What I mean is actually identifying people before they actually acquire the diagnosis. This is a very important piece of work that came out nearly 25 years ago from the Institutes of Medicine in the United States. And it defined prevention as everything that happens before the so-called onset of a disorder. And there are three ways that you can think about prevention. One of them is to do it to the whole population. So vaccination is a classic example of universal prevention. Or you can do what's called selective prevention, targeting people who are exposed to risk factors for a disorder. So, for example, targeting people who are children of people with a mental disorder who might have an increased risk of developing problems themselves. And then there's indicated prevention, which is identifying people who already begin to show signs and symptoms of a disorder but don't yet have the full disorder at the level of a diagnosis, and intervening at those first signs and symptoms. We do this in a range of physical health problems. We do this with skin cancers. We do this with cervical cancer, for example, where we detect abnormal cells and then treat those before they become cancer. We can also do this with mental disorders, where we treat people with the early signs and symptoms of a disorder. And then early intervention really spans over into the early case identification and treatment at the earliest possible stage of a full syndrome of a disorder. And so the area where we've argued we'll get the biggest, you know, the greatest value for money at the moment is in that triangle between indicated prevention right through to early detection and early treatment. And that's the work that we've been pursuing over nearly two decades at the HYPE program in Melbourne at Origin. And prevention and early intervention really doesn't have to understand all the causes of a disorder in order to engage in prevention. If we wait to understand everything that causes borderline personality disorder, we'll never be able to do anything. What we need to do is to identify risk factors for either the persistence of problems or the deterioration of problems, rather than actually the onset of a disorder per se. So what prevention and early intervention is aimed at doing is detecting the earliest possible signs and symptoms and then intervening at the level where we prevent progression to more severe problems. Now, that's not just about the diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder. As you've heard from the earlier slides, what we're also trying to prevent is problems with social networks, problems with the transition from education into vocation, and a whole range of physical health problems. We're trying to prevent the whole range of poor outcomes that are associated with severe personality disorder. And the way we think about that is to use a schema called clinical staging, which is was developed at Origin by my colleague and the director of our research centre, Professor Patrick McGorry. And staging is really a subtyping strategy that was borrowed from cancer and from heart disease, where you'll talk about stage 1, 2, 3, or 4 disorder. And as in cancer, the stage of the disorder determines the kind of treatment that you get. So, for example, in a simple skin cancer, you in stage 1, you would just simply cut out the lesion on the skin, and that cures the cancer. Whereas late-stage skin cancers like melanoma require very heroic and extensive treatments. And similarly, the theory in personality disorder and in early intervention and prevention for mental disorders is that treatment needs will differ by stage, and that we'll be able to do more benign but more effective treatment in earlier stages of the disorder. To extend my egg analogy, you can see there a picture of an egg with some Band-Aids on it. And when the cracks start appearing, we want to try to heal those cracks rather than wait for the egg to break. And you can see the next picture, which shows what would really be the current state of play, late intervention. This is the patient who turns up and gets admitted to treatment very late in the course of the disorder, and it really is like trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But importantly, prevention can't happen in silos. We can't prevent borderline personality disorder separate to psychosis, separate to mood disorders, separate to eating disorders. We need to be able to integrate the prevention of disorders into one cohesive whole. And you can see in the slide that's headed clinical staging, diagnostic utility and stepwise care, you can see the various stages down the left-hand side there. And you can see that and this is an attempt to present how young people present in clinical practice. They don't present having read the diagnostic manuals and saying, I've got schizophrenia or I've got bipolar disorder. They present with a bit of this and a bit of that. Young people present with maybe some features of schizophrenia, but some features of bipolar disorder, some mood problems, and maybe some personality problems, all rolled into one. And it's not a given that they will go on to develop any one of those disorders. Sometimes they naturally get better. Sometimes treatment stops progression. And we need to think of how we're going to respond in a proportionate way in those early stages of disorder, not just launch into the heavy-duty treatments to start with. It might be that in early-stage disorder, we need just simple interventions that are aimed at helping the family to manage with the young person, some support for the young person in their educational environment, and maybe some anxiety management. That might be enough for the early stages of these disorders. But we need to do it for personality disorder integrated with prevention of other disorders. And the prevention field suffers too much from fragmentation, where people look at these end-stage disorders and then work backwards when they think about prevention. So the question that we need to ask is not what's the best psychotherapy for borderline personality disorder. What we need to ask is how can we intervene early at the scale required by the prevalence of the disorder? Borderline personality disorder affects 3% of young Americans, and so you need to think, how are you going to make a health system that's fit for purpose that will actually fit the needs of these young people with borderline personality disorder? Too often, we try to fit the young people into the health system rather than fit the health system to the young people. And so we really need to be able to tackle the latter of those, that is to be able to respond to the needs of young people with BPD, recognizing that the very disorder itself really mitigates against getting effective care. And so we need to do better at fitting the health system to those young people. So what we need to know is to clarify the comparative effectiveness of some of these specialised services over and above just good high-quality care. It might be that high-quality care is the effective ingredient of all those studies that I've mentioned. We need to know at what point and to what extent we should be offering individual therapy. At the moment, really the only thing we do when we think of personality disorder is say, well, you need individual therapy, but that's inaccessible to many people with the disorder. And we also need to understand the level of training and competency required for effective delivery of services. To deliver many of these psychotherapies requires intensive and highly specialized training and skills, which is always going to make it challenging to disseminate in a health system that has to cater for tens of millions of young people. Mm. And then we need to finally change the culture of mental health services. We need to think, who's going to argue for late intervention? When you think about it, we don't do this in any other part of the healthcare system, and especially in physical health. We don't tell people who present to an emergency department with chest pain to go home and sleep it off and come back if they feel worse. Yet we do this in mental health all the time, and we particularly do it for borderline personality disorder. We tell people they're not sick enough, they're not trying hard enough, that somehow they should be worse before they come back. So we set up all the contingencies of the health system to make people get worse before we offer treatment. Mm. So I've argued, and my team have argued, that we really need to get our head out of the sand. We need to stop delaying the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder because of fear of stigma. There is stigma associated with the diagnosis, but the evidence is now very strong that personality disorder is a reliable and valid diagnosis in young people, and that we should stand up and challenge the ignorance and prejudice and discrimination among the health workforce rather than accept this stigma. We wouldn't accept that it's appropriate to not diagnose somebody with HIV because this is a stigmatized syndrome. That would be a death sentence to not make that diagnosis. I would argue that it's a death sentence to people with borderline personality disorder to not make the diagnosis because we know that there are effective treatments, and we also know that there are some treatments that are inappropriate or harmful. So we need to address mistaken beliefs like the belief that personality pathology is transient or somehow a normal part of development in young people. We need to address the belief that the diagnosis is not allowed. That's a myth that looms large. It's never been disallowed. It's been discouraged, but it's never been disallowed. We need to disabuse people of the idea that there is something developmentally special about the age of 18 that means you can't make a diagnosis before that age and can afterwards. And we need to abandon misleading terms like adolescent personality disorder or emerging personality disorder. This is personality disorder, and it warrants fair treatment, and people should expect to be dealt with fairly and equitably in the health system. So just to finish my slides, the point I really want to make is that this is not rocket science. Culture change in mental health services is necessary, but it's not sufficient to help young people and to achieve effective early intervention. We also need to be offering training and investigating effective treatments. Borderline personality disorder needs a seat at the policy and planning table. We need health planners and politicians to see that early intervention for borderline personality disorder is a best buy in mental health. And we also need early diagnosis and treatment as a priority, and we need the treatment to fit the needs of patients and families, not the reverse. So that's really what I wanted to say in terms of my kind of my slides, and I'm happy to field questions or any comments that people might have.
Andrew, this has been such a compelling talk. As you know, I hail from New Zealand, and their clinicians generally are very wary of diagnosing adolescents with borderline personality disorder, primarily because they argue it's not necessary for the adolescent to meet criteria for BPD in order to access specialized treatment. So people tend to sort of diagnose things like complex PTSD or emotion dysregulation and really shy away from applying the label of BPD. And you've presented a very cogent argument, essentially, you know, about the only way to reduce the stigma is actually to apply the diagnosis where it's valid. And also a corollary in order to enhance people's access to treatment, and the corollary of what you're saying is that we won't know the extent of the problem and actually be able to successfully persuade our governments to invest the resources in primary intervention and prevention unless, you know, we're actually accurately diagnosing people. I'm interested, what kind of early intervention are you advocating? What do you think, based on your read of the literature, what do you think is required?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And I think at this stage, I went over it reasonably quickly in the slides. But I think the slide that I put up there, the point that I really wanted to make was that we know that any of the structured treatments is better than treatment as usual. And treatment as usual, sadly, can sometimes be maltreatment as usual. That is, borderline personality disorder is notable for the fact that bad treatment can actually harm people in the health system. And so I think that many of the structured interventions that are in the literature, whether it be DBT or whether it be the MBT for young people, or whether it be the individual therapy that we practice called cognitive analytic therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, there are a whole lot of three-letter therapies that have some evidence. But I think if you read that literature very carefully, and we've published on this, that actually all you can say from that literature is that structured treatments for borderline personality disorder that are based on an understanding of the disorder and a model of the disorder that is respectful and caring are more effective than what happens in the health system at the moment. And so I don't think anyone should read that literature and say, I can do whatever I like. What they need to be doing is intervention based on those fundamental principles of those treatments. We've actually got a study we're just analysing the data for now. And we published the protocol paper called the MOBI study, and we're going to be publishing that outcome paper in 2018. And what we wanted to do was try and understand how simple you could make treatment in the health system, not how complex. Most of the treatments for borderline personality disorder tend to get more complex over time. And we were interested in this problem of how can you actually scale up treatment to cover an entire health system, how simple can it be? And sadly, I can't share the data with you right now.
Andrew.
I'm sorry, but
you can't just give us a little teaser?
I don't have the final analysis. That's the problem.
Okay,
but essentially,
enough.
What I can tell you is that we compared a HYPE program, which is not the most complex intervention anyway, but it is a specialist intervention. We compared that with a group who came to our HYPE program, and rather than receiving individual psychotherapy, they received the whole treatment model, but they received a kind of a sham psychotherapy. And then we had a group in a youth mental health service that was specialised in seeing young people, but wasn't specialised in borderline personality disorder, and they received that youth mental health service plus this sham psychotherapy. And so it's a fairly basic intervention. It certainly requires specialist skills in dealing with young people, but it doesn't require a lot of complex training. And so we're interested to see how those three treatments compare. And look, either way, whether the most complex treatment is the best, as long as all the groups get better, then it says something about how we might gear our health system to be able to meet the needs of the many hundreds of thousands of people who have borderline personality disorder. In the US, the numbers are staggering. You know, if you think about 3% of young people in the US with borderline personality disorder, that's a lot of young people.
That's a huge amount of young people. I'm interested to, because when you look at prevention, of course, you have to cast the net quite, you know, more broadly. And therefore, you know, you're looking at huge numbers of people that you might be wanting to get a particular preventive treatment out to. So we've had a question come through from someone who wants to know, what if any, is the role of regional hospitals in supporting the initiatives that you're describing? So from your point of view, what can be the role of regional local hospitals in terms of responding to this challenge?
Yeah, so I don't pretend to be an expert in the US healthcare system, but I do, you know, I have talked to many people about the situation in the US. I think that the hospitals are going to bear the brunt of this problem anyway, because they're often the last port of call, emergency departments and hospitals. And I think that it's in the interests of hospitals to promote effective early intervention for personality disorder, because otherwise these young people end up in inpatient units, often that aren't well equipped to deal with the problems, and often in a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where they come in and the problems get worse. And clinicians are always familiar with this scenario of someone who is admitted and then deteriorates in hospital, and people then become very anxious about discharging the person because they might be threatening to kill themselves if they're discharged, or they might be harming themselves within the hospital. I think regional hospitals have to be a part of the solution, and if they can kind of serve as the catalyst to initiating early intervention, then I think that's a very positive thing. It might be too kind of obtuse an analogy, but it's a little bit like the power companies that, you know, face the choice of building new generators, or they can actually get involved in energy saving instead. This is the equivalent of energy saving by going out there and changing the way people access the health system in order to lessen the load on those regional hospitals, rather than just having to keep building beds that don't actually prevent suicide and certainly don't prevent any of the bad outcomes. And in fact, once people get into this cycle of hospitalization for their problems, it tends to entrench these functional impairments that I'm talking about, because if you spend the best part of your transition from adolescence to adulthood in and out of an inpatient unit, then you're not going to be engaged in education and all the kind of social and vocational milestones that you need to make the transition to functional adulthood.
Exactly. And so going by what you've been arguing for in a very persuasive way across your talk, inpatient clinicians need to be willing to diagnose borderline personality disorder in adolescents, if the adolescent actually meets criteria for it, and provide accurate information about, you know, what we do know about treatments and what doesn't seem to be useful.
That's exactly right. Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. I think that's exactly right, and I think that the other myth about borderline personality disorder in young people is that admission to hospital is always bad. Now, I'm not advocating for inpatient care to be the mainstay, but this idea that hospitalization is always the wrong thing, I think, is also a dangerous idea. This is a group who have a suicide rate of 8%, where engaging in a kind of game of a standoff can escalate risks. And so sometimes, discretion is the better part of valor, and a brief admission can be used functionally. I'm not advocating by any means this should be the mainstay of treatment, but I do think rigidity in people's views is often harmful. And so some people, you know, I often, when I'm teaching clinicians, they often say, but you should never admit these patients to hospital. Well, sometimes you get painted into a corner. And, you know, the best way to manage that is not to dare the person to make the problems worse.
Absolutely. You don't want to get... flexibility is key, isn't it? Really thinking carefully about the principles of what you're doing and when and how. And as you say, short-term hospitalizations aren't going to keep someone, you know, they're not going to interfere too much with school or other things. And supporting someone to be effective at home as quickly as possible is also useful. Tell me, what do you recommend that parents look out for? I think this is someone from Australia. They said, what do you recommend that parents look out for? And what's available for parents of teens in Australia?
So, look, what to look out for is the easy bit of that question. The early signs and symptoms of the disorder that even you can see in children and prepubertal young people, but sometimes are difficult to sort out, are things like unstable emotions, excessively unstable emotions, which you've already mentioned, Emily. Also, excessive aggression, and you know, they're the two key kind of emotional indicators, and then impulsivity as well. That is acting before you think in a way that is likely to lead to harm to that individual. There are many impulsive people who do things on a whim that's not necessarily likely to lead to damage. The kind of impulsivity we're talking about here is the kind that might lead to harms coming to the young person. So engaging in excessive drug and alcohol use that's unplanned, engaging in early and impulsive sexual behaviour that often exposes them to risks of sexual violence and, of course, early pregnancy, sexually transmitted infections. Those kinds of problems are really key to look out for. And sadly, you know, you still see people who think that these kinds of problems are development, clinicians who will say, well, this might be developmentally normal. And these things are out of the range of normal development. We know from a whole range of longitudinal studies of young people following them into adulthood that actually most young people manage the transition from childhood to adulthood very well. It's a bit of a myth of storm and stress, and that this is inevitably a highly dramatic period with these kind of extreme behaviours. While there is a normative rise in these behaviours, though, that level of extreme is always going to be in the clinical realm, and clinical help is important for those things. The next thing to look for, really around puberty and post-puberty, which is when these disorders, borderline personality disorder, tends to become evident, is for the more formal features, so unstable emotions, an unstable sense of self, excessive aggression, as I've said, this kind of impulsivity, interpersonal problems with, you know, severe extremes of ups and downs in relationships, and a really unstable and poorly formed sense of self. So essentially it's these problems with self, other people, emotions, and problems with behaviour. And we've argued that really from around puberty you can actually detect the features of the disorder. And a very interesting study that a colleague in Belgium, Barbara de Klerk, has just done and presented at the most recent International Personality Disorder Conference, was showing that the features of borderline personality disorder can be identified in young people and are relatively stable even in children. So I do think early detection is feasible. The next step about what's available is a much sadder story. In Australia, we have a pretty good health system compared with many other parts of the world, but even in Australia, getting systematic early detection is incredibly difficult, and I field emails from all over the world of people desperate for help for their young person so they can detect the problems. They know they've got a problem, but they have tremendous difficulties accessing the system. What I can advise to parents is to keep going, is to not take no from an answer, for an answer, and to keep advocating and try to find a sympathetic and well-educated clinician who is equipped to make the diagnosis and offer those basic structured elements of care. But very often in Australia, in North America, throughout the English-speaking world, in fact, but also even in some of the other more progressive health systems in Northern Europe, still borderline personality disorder is a highly stigmatized disorder, not diagnosed in young people, and those people are either systematically excluded from the health system or, as you say, given these substitute diagnoses for which there are specific treatments that are often not the right treatment for borderline personality disorder. So if you make an early diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which is very common, exactly, particularly in the US, then sending someone down the route of treatment lithium for bipolar disorder medication is very different. Yeah, so they end up on inappropriate medication or what, as I said, described, polypharmacy, multiple ineffective medications. They get weight gain, they get all the health complications from that weight gain, and end up down a very different pathway. And I've seen many, many young people go down that pathway, very sadly.
That is sad. Andrew, I just want to let you know, I've forwarded it to you as well, so you can read it at your leisure, but you are getting a lot of emails, very positive ones, with questions and also comments on, you know, your linguistic mastery and how good you are at teaching, etc. And one
thank you, that's very kind.
One person has said somewhat sadly that when a parent said anything in this kind of vein 30 years ago, they were poo-pooed. An early intervention not only helps the child, but is incredibly life-saving for the parent. And I completely agree with that. Now, just there's one more question. And after that, I'm going to let you all know about the upcoming talk for next week, because I think it will answer some of the questions about early intervention and treatments that we have for that. Andrew, another question is there a if there is a hospital or mental health group that wants to change the game, what advice do you have for them about how to plan and to pursue change? So this, it kind of looks like it's a top three, you know, what are the top three actions that they need to take in order to get things moving in the right direction? Andrew, what would you say?
That's a really important point, that there are things we can learn more generally from the implementation of change in health systems. I think the first thing is actually to find out at all levels of that health system what the needs are, and what the requirements are for that that local health system. Unless you have all levels of that health system on board, it's very hard to force change through a health system. We can learn a lot from an area of really interesting scientific inquiry called implementation science. We can learn from them that you really need to understand the local needs of that service, but you can't do this without having your senior levels of management on board. I've seen too many services where people tried to implement this and the senior leadership weren't on board. And some of the things that you need to do for early intervention for personality disorder are invite people into your service who traditionally might have been excluded. And this works not for the faint-hearted, because it does mean inviting in people who are often out of control, often self-harming, and who often present significant risks. And so you can't do this if your managers and senior bureaucrats are telling you to discharge these people and exclude them from the service. So I think you need buy-in at all levels of the service. That's the first thing. The second thing is you need champions of change. You need to have people in these systems who are really keen to work with you, not just in your local team, but in the parts of the service that you'll need, the emergency department, the inpatient unit, various community programs. You need champions who are going to work with you. And then the third thing is you need a skilled workforce. So you need to begin developing your workforce and training them in the basics. I would not launch into running a specialized psychotherapy program. I would launch into an early intervention program for personality disorder. I would be covering the basics of service system reform before I went down the path of specialised psychotherapies. So they're really the top three things that I think need to be done.
Okay. I've got one question of my own, and then we probably need to wrap up. And Andrew, thank you so much for all of this. So you're probably aware of the book that was written by Jim and Liz Dixon-Mazza on DBT skills in schools, dialectical behaviour therapy,
yes,
skills curriculum to be taught in schools. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question. I've met Jim because they're part of the Global Alliance for Prevention and Early Intervention for Borderline Personality Disorder that we have. And I think there's nothing wrong with teaching skills in school. When I speak with educators about this, the early intervention more broadly in schools, they will say, well, what do you want me to drop from the curriculum in order to include your early intervention program? So I do think there's an educational issue about how does this fit within a curriculum and what kind of priority this is. I have no objection to people teaching skills in schools. They're useful skills. I think in terms of prevention, I think that there isn't evidence yet that this is essentially what I would call a universal prevention in that schema I presented earlier. I don't think the science tells us what a universal prevention for borderline personality disorder would look like, because we really don't know what to do and in what dose we should do it. Maybe a brief curriculum in skills training is a useful thing, but there is no evidence that skills training in schools directly leads to prevention of borderline personality disorder. So I think it's not a bad thing to do skills training. I just think that the evidence is very unclear that this prevents either the development of borderline personality disorder, if they're trying to prevent the onset, or progression of problems. And I think people with borderline personality disorder probably require a bigger dose of a more intensive treatment than can be done through a school curriculum. So I think that when you fit it into this overall schema of prevention for personality disorders, I think it's a very interesting innovation. I'd like to see the data that says that it leads to prevention of mental disorders in general. And we know that affective instability is a risk factor, not just for borderline personality disorder, but actually for a whole range of mental disorders. And the problem we have for prevention is that all the risk factors are pretty much the same for all disorders. There are really very few specific risk factors for any one disorder.
Thank you so much, Andrew. This has been such a useful and an enlightening talk. It's certainly covered a lot of ground. And for those of you who may have felt somewhat downhearted at the initial information about the outlook for borderline personality disorder, the rest of the GAP series essentially focuses on outcomes associated with early intervention. And starting with Francesca Paraplechikova next week, who's talking about dialectical behavior therapy adapted for children with a disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which arguably is a precursor of borderline personality disorder. The outcomes are stunning, and we hope that you'll be able to call in and join us at that next Sunday evening, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you're able to donate, it would be lovely to receive your donation. Please don't feel compelled to. If you can't donate, please keep calling in with your questions. They're wonderful, and they inspire people like Andrew to continue doing this awesome work. Thanks so much. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.